United Lutheran Seminary presents the Seminary Explores podcast, conversations on faith, art, people, politics, theology, life, and more, with voices from around the corner and around the globe.
Immigration and the separation of children has become one of the hottest topics in the media and on the American conscience that we have experienced in recent times. And one might say it probably is part of an ongoing debate of who we are as Americans. Kim Davidson is our guest. She's the director for the Center for Public Service at Gettysburg College, and she has recently returned from a tour of Juarez, Mexico, and its sister city across the border, El Paso, Texas, so has firsthand experience of what we're talking about. Why is immigration policy so important right now? Why do you think?
Well, I think in general, you know, we've had different immigration policies that keep changing over the years, hundreds of years in our country. It's important because we need fair and just and consistent policies that allow for people to move, right? Mm-hmm. People move all the time, right? I mean, from the Bantu tribes in Africa to native indigenous folks throughout the Americas, We have moved continuously. So it's important to be able to make that happen in fair and just and consistent manners.
But so I think put it in the biggest perspective possible.
The biggest perspective possible.
We've all, like President Kennedy said, we are a nation of immigrants. We all came here at one time, including Native Americans. Okay,
right.
So some of us, like myself, and maybe
myself
you,
included, yes.
More recently than others. But it's all tied up with other departments in the United States. I mean, we're not just having a dialogue person to person like you and I are,
absolutely.
But the government and its constituencies, trade, agriculture.
Culture, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I think that's what's most important to keep in mind is that we cannot talk about immigration policy in isolation. We have to think about what are the push and pull factors that are making it so that people need to move from their homes. People don't necessarily want to move from their homes. Looking back at history, what has been our motivations militarily, politically, in countries in Central America specifically? How have our influences destabilized regions and economies? How have our trade policies made it so that it's, you know, very difficult to make a living wage in some of the areas? Our agricultural policies, how have we subsidized farmers here, sold corn there, and then make it so those farmers are unable to be able to sell that for a profit and lose jobs?
We are encouraging by our use the growth of certain kinds of weeds in northern Mexico, and then we condemn them for doing it and trying to bring it to the United States.
Absolutely, right.
And we consume it by the ton.
Absolutely.
At any rate, we need to also talk about the fact that in the larger perspective, when immigrant communities come to this country, like my grandparents, my wife's parents, your family, they were here probably very often to fill labor positions. So how did the golden age of America come to be in the late 19th and early 20th centuries? It was by immigrant labor, skilled or unskilled immigrant labor. Mm-hmm. And so the economic impact goes two ways, another push and pull factor.
Absolutely, yeah. And to keep in mind as we think about our policies, when have we invited people in? When have we kicked people out?
Yes.
We talk about, if you go all the way back to the mid-1800s, you know, Chinese folks were invited in to mm-hmm. be able to help build our transcontinental railroad,
right.
And then, you know, 40 years later, kicked out.
Right, we didn't want them anymore.
During, you know, World War II, there was an influx of, you know, 500,000 Mexican laborers that were coming to fill the jobs when our men were out fighting elsewhere, you know, and then all of a sudden those men come back, kicking them out. And so we have a history of bringing people in and kicking people out when it's good economically and good politically.
I want to round out this part of the conversation. There's so much to talk about it that we've got to keep moving. But do we have statistics, or would we need to be very cautious about the statement, they're taking our jobs? Do we have, I mean, The jobs, on the other hand, that they, the immigrants, especially from Mexico and Central America, are often jobs that we don't want.
Right.
We meaning the resident Anglo jobs in labor and in farming and elsewhere.
Yes, I think that is a false statement. Nobody is taking anybody's job. I think it goes back into the assumption on a lot of people's part that the job was theirs to begin with, right? Which is not true. Okay. That can be connected with all sorts of racial tension or even applications to college. But certainly we are at a shortage if you go to the farms, visit farms in the area, you know, big farm area, apple producing and peach producing and agriculture.
It would collapse.
Yeah, absolutely. And there are fewer and fewer people who are making that journey from farm to farm. And so it's really going to affect our food production in the United States in addition to other sectors.
More to say on that, but we've gone this far and not talked about your personal experience. And we want to get around to ICE, the immigration. ICE stands for
Immigrations and Customs,
Enforcement. Mm-hmm. What about your personal experience just recently? Should have started here, but it was important to put it into context. What about your recent experience in El Paso and Juarez?
Oh, well, interestingly enough, we met with Border Patrol to get some of their perspective, but they are a separate agency than ICE, and so we didn't have the ability to meet with ICE, and, you know, a lot of what was said at the Border Patrol was, you know, their practices for apprehending people, but then not necessarily being able to speak about ICE's actions. And they are related, but also separate. Here locally, ICE has been using all sorts of tactics that are based in racial profiling. A lot of people have been taught very well their rights and don't answer the door and things like that, but they're using manipulative tactics. They'll say, are you Jose Gonzalez? And you say, no, I'm not Jose Gonzalez. Well, prove it. Mm-hmm. Well, sir, I am out for a walk. I don't have any ID on me. Okay, we'll get in the car. And they're detaining people. They know that they can't go onto private property or private farms, but they're waiting for people to exit their homes to go to work taking them on the street, pulling them over for something else. Even if the driver has a license and has everything, asking everybody in the car. And these are practices that are unethical and unconstitutional. And we hear that from, you know, immigrant families over and over. And so being able to hold ICE accountable.
What's the check on ICE? How do we keep that accountability?
Yeah, I don't. That is the key question right now.
Border Patrol. We have this is Interior Department. Homeland Security. We kind of know how to approach the Border Patrol police, right? Whatever we might say about it, there is some kind of checks and balances. But you're saying that ICE.
I think it's very difficult to be. I don't know who. I don't know who is. Who is holding ICE accountable at this point? Yes.
Mm-hmm. So we can't really get in to evaluate. Back to El Paso. Mm-hmm. What about the court system? Once these folks are rounded up and put into some kind of detention, and they're if they're lucky enough, they get to go to court, and there are special courts for them. Are there a lot of people being processed at the time?
Absolutely. We've seen this in the news, and then we saw it firsthand when we were there. We were able to visit U.S. District Court in Las Cruces, New Mexico. And, you know, unlike in previous years, if people were detained, they were oftentimes escorted back across the border. But now every single person who is who has crossed without authorization is being prosecuted, and President Trump has said that is the priority. And what that means is that we have courtrooms full. I mean, we saw preliminaries, misdemeanors, as well as felony, and courtrooms 50, 60. Men at a time, a few young women, but mostly men, and it's you know, pretty a horrendous scene. We walk into the courtroom and filled with Central American Mexican men, handcuffed around the wrists, waists, legs, charging eight people at a time.
Mm-hmm. And often without much legal representation. Oh, yes. That's a gray area too. You know, yes. What rights do people who are not citizens have?
Well, in immigration court, they can pay for their own attorney, but they would not be given one in immigration court. Absolutely. But in criminal court, which the U.S. District Court was, they do have public defenders, but you have, you know, the increase because everybody is being prosecuted is so large that we spoke with the judge afterwards. I mean, there's just no way, you know, prosecutors,
public defenders,
will be representing 5, 6, 7 people at a time. Maybe they had a few minutes to meet with the person in advance.
What's the end result? Are they escorted back across the border?
They have been detained. Most of them were being given time served. So depending on how long they had been in detention, that was sort of their time served. But if they had been deported previously and they were being charged with a felony, sometimes it could be even longer. If they were to come back in, it would be even longer again. But most of the, you know, I mean, the other thing to realize that most of the people that are crossing multiple times are here to reunify with family.
Oh, you know, it's a catch 22.
It's a catch 22. I think even the people who are unauthorized, you know, something like 60% have come in with authorization and have overstayed because our system to, people say, oh, do it, you know, do it legally. Well, our system to be able to do it, you know, according to the guidelines is completely broken and nearly impossible. So people are under extreme, extreme circumstances.
We're talking to Kim Davidson about the immigration and the separation of children. We've really only covered half of that topic. I'm Jerry Christensen for the Seminary Explorers, and we should mention that Kim is not only the director of the Center for Public Service at Gettysburg College, but recently returned from a study tour of El Paso, Texas, and Juarez, Mexico. What is the separation of children a regular policy of the United States? Separation of children from their families?
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely not.
We said that the immigration situation
is not new,
but the separation of children is new.
Well, it's new in this regard. I would say it's not new in that it's a tactic that this country has used over the years to maintain control and power over people from slavery. People were taken away from their children, separated. Japanese internment, children were taken away. Even our Native American, children were sent away to school. So it's not new in that sort of historical context. But it is new in these last few months for this issue, because previously families were being able to, you know, be kept together. And it is a tactic to use to really
frighten them. Is it really to try to tell, especially males who are thinking about coming across the border, you're going to lose your family if you do this?
What's the tactic?
I mean, the goal is to try to get people to say, I'm not going to do this because I don't want to lose my family.
I think that's the stated tactic, is to keep people out. But I think it's also just the abusive criminalization of Black and brown folks that we have done for centuries.
Yes. We're finally around to the question, however you define it, is this what you would call racism or disdain, as we've seen in the past, for other immigrant groups, for certain people?
Oh, absolutely. I don't think that there's any way to not see it in that fashion. If you look historically at who the United States has kicked out and who they have allowed to remain, it is always based on discriminatory and racial lines.
We haven't built a fence around Canada yet, and we haven't built a fence around New York City, where many of our immigrants come from. Even if we don't describe it as racism, it's something to do with a disdain for people we don't think are acceptable at this time. What can we do about all this?
I think that's where people are very overwhelmed, right? Because it seems so out of our control. But certainly to inform yourself, to do as much reading, to be able to call your representatives for those of us that have that power, to vote for those of us that have that power, to not ignore our history. So certainly using those strengths that we have. There has been plenty of protests and vigils and demonstrations across the country that have had considerable power. So to join those, specifically at the lead of immigrant rights groups, we have great immigrant rights groups locally as well as statewide and regionally. Pennsylvania Immigration and Citizenship Coalition is leading the way for the state of Pennsylvania. So to connect with those immigrant rights groups, find out what you can do with them, join their protests, demonstrations, but then also be able to connect with immigrants locally in your community and put them at the center of this, right? We often dehumanize people and victimize them, and be able to talk to people about what is their experience, what do they need, not what we think that they need, or what, you know, meet them where they're at, not where we want them to be. So that is central to it, to learn as much as possible. I think that people can donate specifically to legal organizations that are trying to reunify, that are trying to defend. It's a huge need. We need more people and more money to make that happen. There's also people that are encouraging, you know, to become a foster parent, and to be able to support families that way. I think the last thing that we haven't really talked about is also to be able to expose what is happening in terms of the profit that is being made off of all of this and immigration, right? So we have
profit.
I think it's something close to $2 billion a year that they give out in contracts. So 60% of the detention centers in this country are privately run. And so all of the prisons that are privately run, and the people that are transporting individuals, and I mean, it goes on and on. Those are contracts that are given. So who is running the prisons? Exposing all of that, how much profit there is from tax dollars that's going into corporate hands to criminalize and lock up immigrants.
It gives a whole new meaning to the statement, bring us your tired, your poor, your immigrants yearning to be free, your masses yearning to be free. It gives a new meaning. Bring us your poor, your tired, so we can make a couple extra bucks.
Yes. So to expose that as well, and to understand it, and to understand how these policies are interrelated, and not just here domestically, but internationally as well.
Legal help is right on the front line, I'm sure, because that's the immediate need. People are incarcerated. And they need to have, and usually can't afford in those circumstances. Mm-hmm. But who are we, after that, who are we trying to talk to? Who are we trying to tell that we've not to do these things? Is it Congress? Is it our, I don't want to say write your congressman. I mean,
I think that's part of it. Yeah, I mean, there's immediate needs, right, to stop what is happening in terms of separating of children. Also to stop things like, you know, international right for people to enter a country and present themselves to authority and seek asylum. If we're denying that right, then, you know, we need to be held accountable in the international system as well. So yes, right to Congress people.
We decided before we began this conversation, Kim and I, that we would not talk about current policy of the president and his staff, because the situation is so in flux that it might be different tomorrow or the day when this is finally broadcast. But we do know that things, they are changing. So protests are having some effect, so I should encourage people who want to take action on this to be able to do it. Our guest is Kim Davidson, director of the Center for Public Service at Gettysburg College, who recently has come back from a study tour of Juarez, Mexico, and El Paso to tell us about immigration and the separation of children. I'm Jerry Christensen for the Seminary Explorers. Have a very good day.
You have been listening to The Seminary Explores, a production of United Lutheran Seminary with campuses in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, and Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. We invite you to visit our website at unitedlutheranseminary.edu. Opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of United Lutheran Seminary or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.